Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture with me, Padraig Reedy. So, Keith Conharris, welcome to Little Atoms. We're here this week to discuss your new book, Strange Hate, Anti-Semitism, Racism and the Limits of Diversity. Where did this book come from? Was there a spark where you thought it must be written, or it's an incident, perhaps?
There were many sparks where I thought this must be written. I never thought I'd write a book about anti-Semitism. I write a lot about Jews, about the Jewish community, and I've always refused to define my Jewishness in negative terms. Mm-hmm. I was always much more interested in living Jewish communities than in dead ones and in ones under threat. But there came a point where there was no way of ignoring it. And that was partly due to Corbyn's election as Labour leader in 2015, but some of the roots of this of the book go back further than that. In 2014, I wrote a book called Under Civil War, which was about the conflict within the British Jewish community over Israel. And that conflict, which has been heating up for years, that intra-Jewish conflict, has been worsened by anti-Semitism. Certain groups of the Jewish community feel that other groups are colluding with or providing cover for anti-Semitism, and that deepens what is already a very, very difficult conflict over Israel. So this book has been building for some years, and as much as anything else, it was an attempt for me to work through some of the intellectual and practical difficulties of how we deal with this impossible conflict that's currently going on.
I think, like, going a little further into that, a lot of the things that were internal, I suppose, to the Jewish community, and have, even within the left wing of the Jewish community, have become incredibly public in a sense, and have moved far beyond the community. Things like the conflicts between groups like the Jewish Labour Movement and Judas and things like that. But those didn't emerge just on the day Corbyn was elected by any means.
No, and one of the things that you're seeing at the moment is a kind of playing out of what are often grudges and conflicts that go back decades even. You see that with some of the Jewish anti-Zionist left who feel, and quite reasonably in fact, that they've been abused and marginalised within the Jewish community for a very long time. And while I acknowledge that feeling, and I think they're justified in feeling that way, they are now currently playing out, if not exactly a revenge, but they now have a bigger platform from which to fight back. So to some extent they're using non-Jewish opinion as a way to fight internal Jewish battles. But that's not unique to them.
No.
That happens to some degree across the board. But I have to say that I've always felt that communities, ethno-religious communities, should wash their dirty laundry in public. I don't like the idea of communities circling the wagons. I think bad things happen when you do. But the experience of the last few years has taught me that washing dirty laundry in public also has negative effects and creates openings for external actors who may not have the best interests of Jews at heart.
So chapter headings are, you know, fairly not provocative, I guess, but we start off with just what the hell is happening, which I think we've kind of done. But chapter three, rather, is titled "How the Jews Ruined Anti-Semitism," which is an interesting place to start from. What do you mean by that?
Well, we ruined anti-Semitism by making it complicated. There was a time when Jews and non-Jews knew what anti-Semitism was, but we mucked up that clear picture of anti-Semitism as essentially Nazism.
And that simple picture of which you describe as consensus anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I talk in the book about what I call consensus anti-Semitism, which is virtually all Jews will recognise it as anti-Semitic, and also non-Jews, Jewish anti-Semites, see Jews as a unity. So it's targeted at all Jews, or almost all Jews. But in the post-war period, that kind of anti-Semitism, which still exists, is still a force, has over time given way to what I call selective anti-Semitism. And selective anti-Semitism is anti-Semitism directed at certain kinds of Jews, usually combined with philo-Semitic love directed at another kind of Jew. So when I say how the Jews ruined anti-Semitism, what I mean is that our diversity made anti-Semitism much more complex. For the anti-Semites as well, right? I get the impression that anti-Semitism isn't quite as much fun as it used to be, because most anti-Semites, although not all, do recognise that Jews are not identical. So they have to somehow fit their hatred of Jews into an acknowledgement that not all Jews are hateable.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that as much fun as being a good old-fashioned Nazi.
It's probably because, you know, the post-war consensus is very few people are going to out and out say, yes, I am a racist, yes, I am anti-Semite. So you have to complicate things by saying this kind of person but not this kind of person.
Well, I also say in the book that the Nazis ruined anti-Semitism as well. And they ruined it by going so far that it delegitimized more subtle forms of anti-Semitism and associated people who may have a distaste for Jews but not want to kill every single one with the Nazis. So in the post-war period, that consensus that Nazis are a bad thing has actually been not particularly helpful. And I actually talk about this in my previous book as well, Denial of the Unspeakable Truth, which came out last year. And I talk about how consensus isn't necessarily always a particularly helpful thing, because it's a consensus of what is speakable, right? Rather than a consensus about what people actually feel inside.
Yeah.
So you can't talk like an old-style Nazi very easily anymore, although you could argue that it's becoming resurgent in recent years. So you have to kind of hide or dissemble if you want to hate Jews. So selective anti-Semitism is, to some extent, a response to the fact that the Nazis made anti-Semitism very difficult.
But you do, I mean, you bring up this, some fascinating quotes from Mass Observation from, I think it was 1946 or 48.
Yeah, I cribbed them from Simon Garfield's book on the subject. I didn't go into the archives myself.
But where you think, I mean, in our heads, you know, there is European anti-Semitism, then there's, as you say, there's the Holocaust, where everyone goes, my word, that was terrible. Maybe we've gone too far in this. But still, in 1946, 1947, British people are quite openly saying Jews are a problem. You know, Jews, you know, we don't think Jews should be allowed in the country. But as you point out, there is that point where no one's saying we should kill all of them all the time.
Well, I think it's one of the distinctive characteristics of British anti-Semitism, that it's often been very corrosive and certainly an important thread in British history. But it has tended to avoid the more violent kind of expression that you've seen in other countries. But even that sort of sotto voce anti-Semitism declined in the post-war period.
Yeah.
Along with the decline in racism as a speakable option.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that Britain suddenly became an anti-racist country. I don't think it did. I think racism and anti-Semitism have a broad and deep presence in British life, as in other countries as well. But a openly anti-Semitic and openly racist discourse became gradually, or not so gradually even, delegitimized in the post-war period.
Mm-hmm. While we accept the idea that, as a society, the very few people, apart from, I guess, like extremists like National Action, will stand up and say, yes, we are definitely anti-Semitic, yes, we are definitely racist. So we have the societal concept of racism. But I mean, I've seen Nick Griffin say that he's not a racist. I've seen David Irving say, oh, I don't hate Jews, I hate Zionists, this kind of thing. But so we've got this on one level, but very few of us have probably fully internalize that idea, isn't it? What you suggest?
Well, it's easier to adopt a facade of anti-racist discourse than mm-hmm. it is to be an anti-racist. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I argue, I think quite strongly in the book, is that anti-racism is actually really, really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies not just to people like Nick Griffin, who clearly are racist and just want to put a thin veneer on top of it for the sake of respectability. That difficulty even applies to people who define themselves as principally an anti-racist and have been involved in anti-racist activity for decades.
Yeah.
I don't think there's been enough awareness of how tough it is to really live in an anti-racist manner.
I think the example that springs to mind that you mentioned in the book is the case of Jeremy Corbyn's comment about Zionists not understanding British irony, which you, I wouldn't say quite cut some slack on, but bring a level of understanding to.
Well, I think that comment, which has become quite.
Maybe you start and sort of explain to the readers and listeners in case anyone missed that.
That was a public meeting, I think, held at the Houses of Commons. I think it was before he became... Well, no, it's definitely before mm-hmm. he became Labour leader. And he was reported as making a scathing comment about Zionists not understanding English irony mm-hmm. despite living here all their lives. It was actually a bit more specific than that. What he was referring to was... a couple, I think it was two, very well-known grassroots pro-Israel campaigners who were asking awkward questions and being quite disruptive. And these people are fairly notorious in pro-Palestinian circles. And they're fairly notorious in Jewish circles as well. They're fairly exasperating and awkward presence. So what Corbyn was saying was directed at those specific individuals. So that mitigates it somewhat, but it doesn't let him off the hook completely, because it would be one thing to say to them they have no sense of irony. Fair enough, that's fair comment, that's a common or garden mild insult. But then bring into the fact that they lived in England all their life, and he was negatively comparing them to, I think it was the Palestinian ambassador who did understand irony despite the fact that he was not British. And I think that does take you into anti-Semitic territory. But I think the reason for it, it was often, when that incident came to light, it was treated by some of Corbyn's distractors as, aha, the mask finally slips, right? We can see through all the verbiage, you can see here is an anti-Semitic remark. And this is a proof that he is anti-Semitic. That's his real nature. But I think it's a bit more complicated than that. What I think it was as a response to exasperation and annoyance and anger, he let fly.
Mm-hmm.
And when he let fly, he drew on deeper wells of probably unconscious discourse that was anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why anti-racism is difficult. Anti-racism has to be strong enough to survive. I say this in the book, it has to survive those periods when the other is being an absolute pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
If it can't survive that, then you have to look to yourself and say, how deeply anti-racist am I?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down.
So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Listening to Little Atoms this week, we're talking to Keith Con Harris about strange hate, anti-Semitism, racism, and the limits of diversity. Keith, we'll come back to what you were just addressing just before the break there about, you know, getting on with people even when they're being, you know, anti-racism, even when the other side are wrong, so to speak. But I want to talk about, take it back to, we were talking about the Nazis and the Holocaust. Now the Holocaust, you know, kind of looms over any discussion. What kind of damage, in a way, does the Holocaust do to anyone trying to write about contemporary or, you know, modern day or almost non-Nazi related anti-Semitism, I guess?
Well, there's a real double bind when writing about the sort of anti-Semitism that we're seeing in Britain at the moment, say in the Labour Party. By using the term anti-Semitism to describe it, a term which is closely associated with the Holocaust, then you either risk making contemporary expressions of anti-Semitism seem utterly trivial, or conflating the two, suggesting that Jeremy Corbyn's remark about two Jews not understanding irony being the same as dropping the Zyklon B out of the canisters as Auschwitz, which is clearly absurd. So it's a real problem, and I think one way we have to address that is to see the Holocaust as certainly part of the history of anti-Semitism, both modern anti-Semitism and anti-Semitism going back on a much longer time scale, but not necessarily a prototypical example of it. In some ways, the Holocaust was very atypical, but it's a very difficult argument in a way to make, because there are huge minefields here. People are incredible. Jews are incredibly sensitive, and not just Jews as well. And to some extent, that's right to be sensitive about it. But I think the Holocaust, the way that it dominates discussions of Jews and anti-Semitism, it's not helpful. It's not helpful. And I'm not saying we should ignore it, but we should perhaps understand it better in its context and in its times.
I think a lot of, I guess, as you say, a lot of people will, you know, the immediate thing is any kind of accusation or suggestion that, you know, an action or deed or words might be anti-Semitic. The immediate thing is, are you calling me a Nazi? And then if you, as you say, it's like, if you're not calling me a Nazi, then I'm not anti-Semitic. So what are you saying here? And then it opens it up, I guess, to all the suggestions which always come through, or at least have come through hugely in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. I mean, God, 4 or 5 years we've been talking about this now, of accusations of bad faith, which in themselves...
Well, to be fair,
yeah,
most critics of Corbyn from the Jewish community don't call him a Nazi.
Mm.
I mean, there are a few people on the fringes who do engage in accusations that are that rash.
Yeah.
Most people are more careful not to do that. But you mentioned bad faith there, and that is the issue which is dominating the anti-Semitism debate in Labour for as long as it's been going on, which is this incredibly circular process. When someone makes an accusation, the other person saying, no, you're doing this to as a way of defending Israel.
Mm.
So, and recently, I don't know when this podcast will come out, there was Pete Wilsman, who was on the member of Labour's National Executive Committee, talking about, essentially arguing that most accusers of Corbyn are from the Jewish sections of the party, are essentially agents of the Israeli state, which is an argument that essentially they're cynics taking the money and not making accusations that based on real emotions.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is those are also met by counter accusations too, which is that these denials of anti-Semitism are not made in good faith either.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's true. I think I certainly see with Jeremy Corbyn personally, the accusation that he is an anti-Semite offends his deepest sense of self.
Yep.
And I think that's true with a lot of people who've been called that. And it is deeply wounding for them, to the point that it's very difficult for them to hear the good faith in the accusations. It is also difficult to hear the good faith in the denials, which isn't to say that everybody's right, because I don't think everybody's right.
Mm.
But I think that this is not a cynical debate. There are cynics who are some.
Yeah.
Who know exactly what are doing it and are playing other people like a piano. But I think that's almost all minority. I think everybody involved in this is very passionate and very hurt by what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that everyone's equally responsible, but it means that it's wrong to see this as a clash between cynics and real people, because it's not.
Mm. I think there's a strong strand in your book where you talk about the very strict Enlightenment idea of there is the individual, there is the perhaps religious identity, there is the political identity, and that we can divide these out entirely, and that, you know, and that it's almost, I suppose, an almost kind of Christian kind of hate the sin, love the sinner type thing, where you can just completely separate, kind of say, I can have complete respect for an individual's integrity, but I can entirely hate their politics, and I can entirely, and not recognizing that the politics, just like a religion, can be a part of an identity that needs to be, if not tolerated, then understood.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the central points of my book. And it's one that doesn't just apply to Jews, it applies to other groups too, which is the inconvenient fact that Jewish identity is often interwoven with particular political identities, usually Zionist, but sometimes anti-Zionist as well. And that's not unique to Jews.
No.
Muslims and Christians and all sorts of other groups see their particular identities as part of a political vision, or vice versa. They don't often see that vision as political, which is a problem. When Jews see being Zionist as part of what it is to be a Jew, they often find it very difficult to acknowledge that Zionism is a political ideology, like any other.
Mm-hmm.
So we get into a terrible mess here, which is that love the sinner, hate the sin, just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's simply a fact that if you attack Zionism without due care,
mm-hmm.
then you will end up making some Jews at least feel like they are personally under attack, mm-hmm. i.e. anti-Semitism. And that leads to a major, major problem, which is I'm absolutely not arguing that Zionism should not be up for questioning, and that to question Zionism is to be anti-Semite. But I am saying that unless you're incredibly careful, that is how many Zionist Jews will see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do in the book is try and sketch out a way forward from that, which was very, very difficult. And I'm not sure I was successful, but at least I had a go.
But there is, the book deals with how in an age of what the social is called super diversity, particularly in cities like where we are in London, New York, so on, you know, Paris, where you know, even in the past 50 years we had you know, you had certain boxes that, like, there may have been a lot of ethnic groups, but there weren't this endless multiplicity of, you know, people that you can no longer usefully pigeonhole or usefully put in a place where these people live in this certain place and they believe this certain thing and they go to this certain, they worship in this certain church or temple. You know, everything becomes an incredibly more complicated thing, even for people who have, as you say, seen themselves as lifelong anti-racist or would describe themselves as really kind of very pro-diversity.
Well, it's a mixture. Yeah. What it creates is a mixture of ignorance and knowledge,
mm-hmm.
a surfeit of ignorance and a surfeit of knowledge. So on the one hand, we have to navigate a society with a multiplicity of different groups and minorities and minorities within minorities,
mm-hmm.
Some of whom arrived quite recently or simply British people don't know that much about, even very well informed British people,
yep.
don't necessarily know well about. On the other hand, we know more than ever, but we know in an unhelpful way, and this is why the online era, I think, has radically transformed things, in the sense that difference is now on show and inconvenient facts about that difference are also on show as well.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been possible 30 or 40 years ago to say, I love Jews, without
yep.
knowing much about what they represent and what they believe politically.
Yep.
The same with Muslims, mm-hmm. right? In an anti-racist way, or even in a racist way, it was possible to feel that you knew them. And that was partly
yep.
because minorities were, until relatively recently, often politically quietist.
Yes,
but once minorities stop being politically quietist, which is, mm-hmm. I think, what has happened, and once their internal diversity and their political commitments are on show, we're often left scrambling around, not knowing quite how to react.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, this odd mixture of ignorance and knowledge, and that's one of the things that's if you look online at debates about anti-Semitism, you see non-Jewish protagonists often have a really weird mixture of knowing quite a lot about certain kinds of Jews, but absolute ignorance about other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really blame them, because it's difficult. And we're not the only minority in this country.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, understanding, it's only been relatively recently that I've been fully aware of how ignorant I was about Islam. I mean, I've known for a long time that they were Shia and Sunni, and I had a vague idea of what they represented. But I didn't know that Shia Islam, for example, has multiple streams within
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And I'm still struggling to try and educate myself there.
Mm.
And so I don't blame people of trying to seize on the little, the sort of the life rafts of knowledge that they can cling on to about Jews. But there's no doubt that it has very serious consequences, and I think it erodes anti-racism, or the possibility of it, because people are suddenly confronted with the fact that minorities or minorities within minorities may believe things that are utterly abhorrent.
Yeah.
And they won't shut up about it.
But we are at least, I guess, you know, it's something I've always obsessed with, at least acknowledging that groups do have their own internal dynamics and internal politics and everything else that goes with it, that you can't simply say these are Jews. Also, when every few years there's a someone will turn up on Facebook or something with a picture of two people from Natura Carta saying, oh, they see these people aren't Zionists either, therefore ergo.
Oh, that still happens. Yeah. That still happens. Yeah. But I think people are slowly, I think we're in the forefront, Jews are in the forefront of this because we are really mouthy and we don't shut up. So in a relatively haphazard way, we've been, I wouldn't say educating, but at least informing mm-hmm. the world that not all Jews are the same. Right? And Muslims are sort of, in their own haphazard manner, also catching up. Internal diversity was not something that when original theories of multiculturalism and diversity and anti-racism started emerging in the 60s and 70s, they weren't really things that were addressed.
Yeah.
And that means that people who grew up as anti-racist during that period often have no idea how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being very charitable here, saying I understand the difficulty in dealing with this.
Mm.
But what I'm not saying is excusing it. Mm. I'm not excusing it. I'm saying that anti-racists are often woefully naive and often smug about the challenges in working for our relatively harmonious, diverse society in the 21st century.
Mm. We tend to get self-described anti-racism when talking about anti-Semitism. As we said, it's still very stuck in an idea of these are, you know, there were terrible things that happened in Europe in the 30s and 40s. And that they're, you know, and a lot of people who say they're fighting Islamophobia tend to almost entirely focus on Western foreign policy rather than really thinking about and the effects of current Western foreign policy rather than focusing on what's happening to people here and now and the argument, again, the discussions about that within communities to an extent.
Well, there tends to be a bifurcation between either ignoring the problematic aspects of certain minority forms of minority politics
mm-hmm.
or treating it as so central that it essentially removes people from anti-racist protection.
Yeah.
So on the left, campaigning against Islamophobia often prevents an engagement with the realities of Islamist politics.
Yeah.
And similarly, with regard to Jews, the fact of majority Jewish support for Zionism often means that Jews cannot be incorporated inside anti-racist practice
mm-hmm.
without a lot of difficulty. But I'm not... People have made this point before, but what I'm not doing is setting Jews and Muslims up against each other.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, you know, why can't you treat us like you treat the Muslims and treat the Muslims like you treat the Jews? And you do see a crude version of that argument going around.
Mm.
What I'm trying to do is develop a form of anti-racism that can survive that knowledge of minority diversity and an acknowledgement of it without compromising.
Mm-hmm. So how do we do that?
Well, I just wrote a book about it. And I'm struggling. I suppose I want to start a debate about this. What I suggest in the book is that the most important thing for anti-racists to do is to restrain love. The reason why we're in this terrible state about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is because most of the key players who have been accused of anti-Semitism have a real philo-Semitic love for particular forms of Jewish tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And they cannot reconcile themselves to the existence of Jews who don't honour those particular traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm suggesting is by restraining love for your favourite Jews, and everyone has their favourite sort of Jews, other than complete neo-Nazis, by restraining love your favourite sort of Jew, it might be easier to relate to your less than favourite
mm-hmm.
sort of Jew. I'm suggesting a kind of way of responding to diversity with restraint and caution rather than a celebratory kind of rhetoric. I'm suggesting a way of being that is guarded, watchful, careful. And it's not a particularly pleasant vision, and it goes against my deepest instincts, which are for dialogue, engagement, love, and all that kind of good stuff. But I think we've reached the point, and I think the internet has a lot to do with it, and social media, obviously, in particular, where to step back from the brink of selective anti-racism and to navigate the diversity that exists, we have to practice something much more careful and much more difficult and much more cautious. But one of the things I do emphasise in the book is that this is not an argument against diversity. In fact, I'd go further. Increasingly in recent years, I'm starting to see come round to the idea that the borders should ideally be as open as possible. And the reason for that is climate change and the millions, if not billions, of refugees that are going to have, that we're going to have in the future. But I'm basically saying, if we have any chance to welcome the huge numbers of people that ethically we must welcome in future decades, then we're going to have to understand that diversity is not always easy. We're going to have a politics of diversity that works better than it currently does now. Because there is no doubt that whilst campaigners against immigration are almost always wrong when they talk about the negative consequences of immigration, if you were to bring in 5, 10, 50 million people in a short space of time in Britain, it would be incredibly difficult.
Yep.
It would cause problems. And I think we should be letting in 5, 10, 50 million people, not necessarily now, but certainly if climate change goes the way it's going within the next 20 or so years. And to do that, we're going to have to let go of naively celebratory versions of diversity and work with a much tougher-minded one. Where we are absolutely committed to the existence of diversity in society, but without any illusions that it's easy to deal with.
It's a great note to end on.
No, it's a horrible note to end on. It's not fun. I mean, this is a fairly frustrating and difficult book that includes the odd joke, partly to take away from the fact that it's so bleak.
Keith Gonzarez's Very Bleak Strange Hate is available from Repeater Books now. Keith, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
This episode of Little Atoms was presented by me, Padraig Reedy, and edited by Sky Redman. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. And remember to check out littleatoms.com for a full archive. Thank you for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.